Goldberg v. Goldberg et al., Jay Chapman Peterson, appellate counsel, and Amy P. Campbell, appellate counsel.
You may proceed.
Your Honor, if I might reserve 3 minutes on rebuttal.
All right.
May it please the Court, ladies and gentlemen, I'm Chad Peterson. I represent the appellant, Michael Hamburg. And if I was to name this case, I think I would call it the case of the contradictory verdict, if I could give it a Hardy Boys type theme. This is a case that arises from Fairfax County Circuit Court. My client, Michael Hamburg, was sued for defamation based upon statements he had made about the plaintiff, and counterclaimed for conversion, basically claiming that he had been fraudulently billed in the course of using her services. The jury came back and found defamation in the amount of $90,000, and then in his counterclaim found for him in the amount of a small amount, nominal amount, plus $45,000 in punitive damages. So basically, both sides were equally successful in terms of winning the claim that they had made. His lawyer then filed a motion for reconsideration saying, how could he have defamed this woman or her business if he was actually successful in his conversion claim? The judge did not reverse the verdict. It went up on appeal. The conversion claim has not been appealed, so we solely have the defamation case in front of you, so that half of the case is solely in front of you. So that brings us to the law of defamation, which has been fairly exhaustively chronicled in the appeals and in the appellate briefing. And I start with just looking at defamation sort of in the larger context of within the First Amendment. We look at defamation as a common law tort where we hold it to a very high standard. And if I look at the cases that we've had probably in the last 10 years, the Shaker case talks about a publication of an actual actionable statement with requisite intent, and then talks about three different aspects you have to have to be an actionable statement. It must be a statement of fact, number one. Number two, it must have defamatory sting, simply saying somebody's left-handed or right-handed. It has to be defamatory sting. Three, it must be false, which, of course, that is typically the issue which is given to the jury. Now, why I'm in front of you today and why this appeal, you granted this writ, and why we're talking about this, is the issue of fact and who determines that. And this court, through multiple written opinions, well-written opinions, has talked about that the issue of whether a statement is a fact or an opinion is a legal issue which has to be determined by the court. And I go straight to the language in the case of Highland. And there were two Highland cases, one written by Justice Lacey in 2007, and then it came back in 2009, and you had another opinion written by Justice Kenan. But Justice Lacey talked about the determination of whether a statement is a statement of fact or opinion is an issue of law, and we conducted de novo review of the five, in this case, the five statements in question. Now,
can I ask, interrupt with a question?
Yes, sir.
When there was the colloquy with the trial judge over the jury instruction, there was a reference made along these lines, and I'm reading at page 125. Your Honor, even if counsel is correct, then I would ask that we give the full binding instruction or the full pattern instruction for defamation, ... What is that? Are those two instructions, were they proffered in the record, or is there anything in the record that is being referred to?
Your Honor, there was no actual proffering of an alternative instruction. There's a dialogue, you call it a colloquy, about the fact that, first of all, that the whole statement was given to the jury without any explanation that there had been a demur ruling, and that the whole statement's given to the jury without any sort of delineation of which one is fact and which one is opinion. Counsel did not have an alternative instruction.
The model jury instruction does what you ask, which is identifies specifically statements in the model jury instruction
right.
That could be focused on by the jury.
And again, I come at it from, and to be honest, if we had not been successful in the counterclaim, this would be a very different appeal, or it might not even be an appeal. But to me, it was the fact that there was clearly a statement of fact that was given to the jury, whether or not the plaintiff had fraudulently billed her customer. That's a statement of fact. I agree, and I don't think anyone can seriously challenge that, and that passed demur. That went to the jury. The jury found defamation, but then they turned around and found conversion.
We allow inconsistent verdicts with juries in criminal cases, and we have often allowed it in civil cases, have we not?
Well,
in other words, the fact that it's inconsistent could mean either or. It could mean you got lucky in one, or he got lucky in the other.
But Justice Kelsey, we're talking about defamation, and defamation is not your ordinary tort. This is not negligence. In other words, you would have to, first of all, isolate the statements at issue and say, just like you did in Highland, these are statements of fact, these are statements of opinion. Clearly, whether or not somebody fraudulently billed is a statement of fact. And then once you've isolated that statement, if the jury then comes back and say, we found conversion, which by definition is the unlawful dispossession of somebody's property, and it matches up with the statement that has been identified as a factual statement, at this point, the whole issue of truth, which is always the response, which is always a defense to defamation, then occurs. So the point I'm making is it's really a two-step process. The judge needed to segregate those statements which were fact versus opinion, which he didn't do, but then on reconsideration, once he knew that the jury had found that there had been a conversion, then he clearly needed to basically say, well, you can't find fraudulent billing. So what do we have left? Well, if you go through the remainder of the statements, they all flow from the fraudulent billing. It's all, well, this goes against my values, and I don't think Loudoun County Public Schools should be engaging in this behavior or supporting this business. Those are classic sort of opinion statements that flow from a factual allegation. And ironically, and in the record, if you look at the demur, in the opposition to the demur that the defendants filed, they even admitted that it was fraudulent billing that was the gravamen of the factual complaint, and the opinions basically flowed from that. So the point that I'm making is, I'm not saying the judge did everything wrong, but once they knew that the conversion claim had come back, at that point, they really had no choice but to vacate the verdict for defamation. Let me just move along. I've talked a little bit about the Highland cases. I want to talk a little bit about some of the other defenses that have been raised, and that is my colleague, when he gets up and very ably, will probably point out a number of things. One, that we somehow waived our objections by letting the email into evidence. I think the Richmond newspapers case is pretty clear, and I don't disagree with it. Then, when a jury is reviewing defamation, they have to be given the full statement so they can actually weigh what it means within the context. And I think Highland 2 also stands for that proposition.
I don't see how you can waive something when you have a successful demur.
Right.
At the front end.
Right.
And then at the back end, you say, well, the jury has to get some guidance on what's opinion and what's fact.
Well, precisely. I mean, you demur on the front end, you kick out statements so that they cannot be the cause of action. At the end of the day, the jury still has to be given the statement itself so they can...
I mean, a jury, you know, we have all this legal training and we read all these cases, we're taught how to parse the cases, but a jury coming into this has no idea about any of this. As far as most jurors are concerned, I suspect, a stinging statement of opinion would be worse, maybe, than some trifling statement of fact.
Right.
And so, without the guidance, how is the jury supposed to know where to give the dollar?
Justin McCulloch, the only thing a jury can do in this case is decide whether or not a statement is false and whether or not there's a requisite defamatory intent. They cannot decide between what is a legal opinion and what is a factual statement. That is not within their decision-making capacity, that they're not, you know, educated in the First Amendment. And I'm a big believer in the jury system. I believe in what they do. But these are legal questions. And again, this court has come down again and again and again saying we protect speech. And one of the ways we protect speech is you can only adjudicate these issues. You can only give to the jury those with your statements.
Why was instruction number 8 given without objection? Everything you say being true, why wouldn't someone jump up and say, absolutely, you can't give instruction number 8. The whole email is not the subject of defamation. We've won this point. Why didn't someone jump up and do that?
And instruction number 8 is the one...
It says the statements in this June 2, 2015 email were false. It's the finding instruction for defamation.
Right.
So, I mean, again, everything you say seems exactly right legally, but the trial judge obviously made a mistake when he ruled on it, but it's an agreed instruction. Usually trial judges move on. They don't, give it a second thought.
Well, I think in terms of preserving the argument, I think counsel, by stepping up and saying that they needed to have a fuller instruction, that they needed to make a decision on fact versus opinion, there was a colloquy for about 10 pages in the in the transcript. Did he proffer an alternative instruction? No, he did not. But again, as soon as that verdict came back, in which case the only statement, which was the true factual statement, was then basically illustrated by the jury to be a true statement, he filed a motion for reconsideration. And again, these are all de novo issues. So these are right back in front of, they were in front of the trial judge, they're in front of you, they were properly preserved in that respect. Was it a perfect trial strategy? Probably not. But the bottom line is the appeal, those issues were preserved. One issue I do want to address, because I know this is going to come up from my colleague, is this issue that the defamation finding was against Mr. Hamburg. The conversion finding was against Morgan Center and not against Ms. Morgan. Actually, if you look at the finding instruction, the verdict form just said Morgan Center. The finding instruction referenced both Ms. Morgan and the Morgan Center, so it referenced both of them. I would also say if you go back to the original email, it makes no distinction. In fact, it actually talks about I am terminating the service of Elizabeth Goldberg and the Morgan Center because of fraudulent billing, and it goes on to elaborate on that. So, again, I think this is one of those odd cases where there was a contradictory verdict, and I agree with Justice Kelsey. Oftentimes we let them stand up, but this is a defamation case, and where we have a straight-up factual issue that has been disproven by the jury, I do believe it's proper to vacate this case. In terms of what would happen next, I would ask that the jury enter judgment on behalf of my client, again, just simply because there's no possible defamation in light of the jury's finding. Alternatively, the court could find that the jury was not properly instructed and basically send the case back to be remanded, but that would be an alternative that I think we'd like to avoid, and I don't think it's necessary. I'll reserve the rest of my time.
3 minutes and 48 seconds.
May it please this honorable court, James Campbell on behalf of Dr. Goldberg. It's important to remember in the record of this case, Michael Hamburg sued my client for fraud on the billing issues. The jury found a verdict in her favor on that fraud. And notwithstanding what counsel says, they drafted the finding instruction on the conversion case. The finding the instruction, the verdict form, is a verdict in favor of the Morgan Center. The Morgan Center is a distinct entity from Dr. Felicia Morgan. It had employees. The $35 compensatory judgment was for an error that resulted in some sort of fee being charged, according to the record. And it pains me that my predecessor did not appeal that obviously unconstitutional 1,275-time compensatory damage, was the punitive damage award. So the first thing to understand is that, as he says, inconsistent verdicts, he's trying to confuse us that they aren't separate parties, separate burdens, separate entities. That is not the case that was tried in Fairfax County. The conversion verdict was not against Dr. Morgan.
That's a very subtle point. You think the jury honed in on when the email, as opposing counsel pointed out, the email didn't particularly distinguish. The finding instruction didn't distinguish, but then the verdict form did. You think the jury astutely honed in on that distinction as opposed to...
Well, they did because, amongst other things, there's billing staff at the Morgan Center.
So you're saying the factual scenario,
right,
and the amount...
Correct. I mean, I don't understand the punitive damage award. It should have been set aside. It should have been appealed. It was not. I'm not here for that today. But the first issue is to understand there are separate proceedings entirely. Most importantly, you can't invite error in a case and then come to this court and hope to be relieved of the error. In this circumstances, the parties flatly agreed to the terms and conditions of the jury instructions. They did so on the night before closing argument.
For a minute there.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
On the defamation instruction.
Yes.
You're quite right. It's based, as far as I can tell, the original finding instruction that referred to the whole email was agreed to and not specifically objected to.
Correct.
But the next day, this is now page 120-ish of the joint appendix, it appears that counsel came back and basically rethought it. And this is before, of course, the instruction was read to the jury. And on page 125, it comes pretty darn close to saying, you know what, we need to parse out the three statements that it has already been ruled upon. Isn't that enough? I mean, does a judge really need an instruction saying that if he gets the point?
Well, there's two issues there. The first issue is that what they say was a problem in their appellate papers is not exactly what happened on the day of trial. I have those very pages you referenced because they're kind of critical. Because counsel said kind of curiously, you know, Judge, I think there might be some issues with the instructions on defamation, and talked about the demur. If you review the record, these attorneys were extremely skillful in how they tried this case. That there were questions almost line by line on the 8 allegations in the complaint that survived demur. Counsel for Dr. Goldberg carefully questioned her about why those 8 Ellens were false. And on the 3 that were sustained, and if you have the email handy, it's in your record at page 6. It's the last paragraph, the last full paragraph before it says, please let me know your questions, where the 3 sentences where the trial court at demur found those allegations to be statements of opinion rather than fact that were excluded. Well, plaintiff's counsel didn't ask Dr. Goldberg a single question about those entries, those questions. What she asked what was asked of Dr. Goldberg were her billing practices and were her billings fraudulent, and on some of these conversations. And the fact of the matter was, Dr. Goldberg fired Mr. Hanberg because she refused to participate in a divorce as an expert witness. He was angry. The very next morning, he offered this email, which defamed her. He lied about what the basis of the termination was. It was Dr. Goldberg that terminated him. And he accused her of terrible things associated with her career. At trial, those issues that they complain about in the demur, after the plaintiff, Dr. Goldberg, put on her case and carefully avoided any mention of those issues, counsel for the defendant got up equally skillfully, and if you look at the record, went through all 8 elements that were survived demur, which were allegations of fact, and asked Mr. Hanberg about those questions, and the defense wasn't they were truthful statements. The defense was explaining why he thought they were truthful in the face of them being false. And so as we consider gatekeeping here, I'm trying to imagine as a trial lawyer who practices in this commonwealth, what would the instruction look like? Well, we don't know what the instruction that counsel had in mind, because on page 125, as you pointed out, he said, I have an instruction that might be helpful, but inexplicably he never tendered it to the court, nor did he ever say what the instruction would do. In their 41-page brief on appeal, they didn't say what the instruction would do. Even in their reply brief, they don't say what the instruction would do. So how would you instruct a jury about evidence that was not presented? In other words, nobody...
But didn't the jury get the entire email?
Well, they get the entire screen, but nobody ever said...
A conscientious jury. Now, I understand your point that, look, this is what the oral testimony was about. Here's the exhibit. It has the entire email.
Right.
A conscientious juror is going to say, well, let's look at this. Let's do our job. And here's some statements of opinion. Court ruled on demur. There were statements of opinion. And so now we're speculating, well, the jury probably went with the oral testimony because that's what they heard on the stand. But they're back there with this exhibit that has the totality of the email. Maybe they were looking at those things too.
Well, we have to presume the jury followed the instructions and the evidence. And if you look at the next to last paragraph on page 6 in the appendix, the June 2nd, 2015 email. And then if you read the record, as we are compelled to do, you won't see a single solitary mention by any witness as to whether anything in that last paragraph, next to last paragraph, was true or false. They fastidiously ignored it. So what would the options have been had the young...
But did the jury instruction tell them that they were not to consider the last paragraph?
No, it did not.
It didn't. So the jury has witness testimony and an exhibit that's also testimony. So what tells them don't consider the last paragraph simply because no witness articulated anything about it?
Because in our system of justice and the law of defamation, to find that a statement is false, some evidence must be proffered that the statement is false. In other words, if you go back to New York Times versus Sullivan and that publication about law enforcement in Alabama after a march by Dr. King and all the reasons that was defamatory, there were things in that statement that were true, like the day of the march, the parties involved in their names, and administrative things, similar to this. The first paragraph says, hey, the Morgan Center and Dr. Goldner are no longer my representatives. Please don't share any information with us. Well, nobody talked about that paragraph either, and there's no complaint or allegation that that was defamatory. But to be defamatory, you have to prove that it's an allegation of fact, that it has defamatory sting. So if you have a writing that doesn't have, it's not an allegation of fact, and does not have defamatory sting, it's just part of the context. In the Highland case, the difference in the Highland case, which they rely upon, is that in Highland there were five separate statements where the advocate for the employee who was defamed claimed they were all defamatory statements. The employer said, you know, those last three, those are opinion. And they stood on that throughout the case. Those are opinion. But evidence was presented over objection in that hearing about those opinions. And then when it came to you in 2007, this court reversed because all five issues went to the jury. But that's a different factual circumstance entirely, because in that case, they heard hours and hours of testimony regarding the three statements that this court ultimately found not to be based in fact. But the eight statements that are identified in the complaint, and the eight statements that survived demurrers, and those are on pages 4 and 5 of your appendix, are all about fraud. They're all about the fraud of, alleged fraud of my client. The case that was tried is not the case they imagine. These issues that they claim were not defamatory were not discussed. There's no evidence to present it to the jury to make a conclusion they were false. And that's how we try cases. If I have a part of a case excluded pretrial, whether it's by a motion in limine or by demur, it's my duty as plaintiff's counsel not to put that issue before the court, not to put that issue before the jury, not to invite error. And when I don't, and then when my opponent acts the same way, and they fastidiously go through the eight allegations that about fraud and ignore those other things, and nobody tells the jury there's anything false about anything else other than those eight statements, what do we do? Do we instruct a jury that somehow please don't pay attention to evidence that nobody talked about? Do we send them a redacted email so they only see the words out of the 687 words, they only see the 550 that are in contest? No. The entire email properly comes in, and that's the guidance of Richmond Newspapers versus Lipscomb. And do we parse out, do we redact the portions that are clearly not defamatory? Do we parse out the ones that are administrative? No, of course not. What do we expect? We expect counsel and the court to obey what the court has determined. And because the Circuit Court of Fairfax County said, these three statements, in my view, are not defamatory, I actually disagree with one of them. I think it is defamatory. But trial counsel didn't push that envelope. Trial counsel elected to obey the order, and the defendant did as well. So as we imagine, what would that instruction look like? What would they have done? The better question is, how come the defendant didn't tell the trial court what it wanted to do? Because the part that I find to be aggravating is if you look on page 125 of the appendix, the argument or colloquy just before the jury instructions were finally decided, he wasn't asking for an instruction that would tell the jury to ignore those paragraphs in the email that I just talked about. He was asking about the full pattern. And what are the elements of the full pattern that were missing? Well, first, did Hanberg write it? Well, of course he did. He admitted it was his email. The second was it published? Well, of course it was. It was sent to the Loudoun County School Board, the person who my client did most of their business with. And number three, was it about the plaintiff? Was it about Felicia Goldberg? Yes, it accused her of fraud. So in this unusual case, the conflict between the verdicts is a red herring. Because different parties, different burdens, and they don't disclose to you what the record discloses to you, that when a billing error occurred that resulted in conversion for $35, that wasn't Dr. Goldberg. The jury didn't find it was Dr. Goldberg. And when Michael Hanberg accused her of fraud, they said, no, you've not proved a case out for fraud. But when they talked about the eight statements that the circuit court specifically approved at demur, And when the plaintiff presented evidence only about those eight statements, and when the defendant presented evidence only about those eight statements, the case was properly before the jury.
Well, the difficult question here is whether or not signing off on Instruction 8 just agreed to it. Put all the statements in the email before the jury, whether or not they were addressed by counsel or not.
Well, the issue is he clearly consented to the instruction. What he asked for, if you look at the model, the important thing, if one were to look at, let's imagine for a moment that the judge said, okay, I'll give the model. What would the model have addressed that the approved instruction did not? Who drafted it? Undisputed Michael Hanberg. Who was it to? Was it published? Undisputedly yes to the Loudoun County School Board. And who was it about? Undisputedly Dr. Felicia Goldberg. So the instruction they claim should have been given would be a matter of harmless error. Because the three issues that were missing from the pattern instruction compared to 7 and 8, the instructions that went to the jury, are those three issues that simply are not an issue in this case. We respectfully ask you to affirm the defamation verdict. When you accuse somebody of fraud and it's false, you should be entitled to your verdict here in Virginia. And if you're so inclined, sua sponte, to find that the punitive damage award is constitutionally infirm, I join my colleagues before on their concepts about the infirmity of things that courts have no jurisdiction to do. Good day.
You have 3 minutes and 48 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honors. I just want to respond to a couple things my colleague said, and a couple of them I did anticipate. If you look at page 125, I got to reach that. The trial counsel, and this is for the Mr. Hanberg, says, well, Your Honor, I did object to the finding right now because I believe that we should be giving the full pattern of finding on the defamation, and there are issues in dispute that we are not informing the jury that they can find on. So the short answer is to answer Justice Kelsey's question earlier was, on this second day, at the last second, yes, he did say we need to have the full finding instruction. So that I do believe that objection was preserved. Now, let me get back to this issue of the two separate entities. Again, if you go to the actual conversion instruction, which is page 59 of the appendix, it says, if you find for the defendant Michael Hanberg on his counterclaim of conversion, then in determining the damages to which he is entitled, your verdict shall be for a sum as will fully and fairly compensate him for the damages sustained as a result of Dr. Goldberg and or the Morgan Center's conduct. So the finding instruction references both defendants. And if you go to the email, which has probably been read multiple times at this point, the email makes no distinction, saying, I want to let you know that the Morgan Center and Felicia Goldberg are no longer associated with Nathan's case and is not advocating for the family anymore. The reason for this termination is fraudulent billing. So again, the facts of the case make zero distinction between these two parties, whether or not somebody is sending out a bill or not a bill. The bottom line is this was always the gravamen of the complaint, that he was being fraudulently billed and this was the issue he brought to the court. The only other issue that I would raise with the court is, again, my goal here is not to sort of make the trial counsel or the trial judge look bad, but just to look at the circumstances as they actually appeared. The reason why we're here is not just because of the jury instructions were flawed, that's clear, but also because once the verdict came back, there became an impossibility of the defamation case. The defamation case became an impossibility because, again, if you reread the allegations, they all flow from this idea of fraudulent billing. Once they found the conversion claim, then basically fraudulent billing goes away. The only other statement, I've been through this so many times, that was still in the case was, well, Dr. Goldberg won't return my calls until I pay her bill. Well, I have to think it's just about any professional, you could probably say that about clients. The bottom line is I think that's a classic case of a statement that lacks defamatory sting. And that is really the only one that doesn't flow from this idea of I was being charged improperly, I was being charged fraudulently.
Technically, a conversion case does not require fraud whatsoever. It's just unauthorized conversion. Could not a jury have just said, no, we're not at preponderance with the fraudulent billing point, but we are at a preponderance with we shouldn't have charged $35.
Well, I don't think you can just look away and ignore the fact they also added on $45,000 in punitive damages. So clearly they found that it was more than just a minor charge.
Yeah.
And again,
you escaped a freight train when that was not appealed.
Well, you know what? I'm here. Bottom line is, ladies and gentlemen, justices of the court, this is a very unusual case. It became more unusual once the jury's verdict was returned. Again, we had the issue where the defamation case became an impossibility, and that is why I will end, as I began calling it, the case of the contradictory verdict. Thank you.
Court will be in recess until 11 o'clock.
All rise.